every day for almost 50 years. Don't you think it's about time you took a vacation? To which Gandhi replied, I'm always on vacation. Of course, the word vacation means empty, vacant. When we practice being completely in the present, life in its fullness is totally accessible to us at all times, precisely because we are outside of time. Time becomes empty, and so do we. Then we too can always be on vacation. We might even learn how to have better vacations if we practiced all year long. If the soil is really polluted, that is, if you're trying to force yourself to feel relaxed and demand of yourself that, quote, something happen, nothing will grow at all, and you will quickly conclude that meditation doesn't work. To cultivate meditative awareness requires an entirely new way of looking at the process of learning. Since thinking that we know what we need and where we want to get are so ingrained in our minds, we can easily get caught up in trying to control things to make them turn out our way, the way we want them to, of course. But this attitude is antithetical to the work of awareness and healing. Awareness requires only that we pay attention and see things as they are. It doesn't require that we change anything. And healing requires receptivity and acceptance, attuning to connectedness and wholeness. None of this can be forced, just as you cannot force yourself to go to sleep. You have to create the right conditions for falling asleep, and then you have to let go. The same is true for relaxation. It cannot be achieved through force of will. That kind of effort will only produce tension and frustration. If you come to the meditation practice thinking to yourself, this won't work, but I'll do it anyway, the chances are it will not be very helpful. The first time you feel any pain or discomfort, you'll be able to say to yourself, see, I knew my pain wouldn't go away, or I knew I wouldn't be able to concentrate, and that will confirm your suspicion that it wasn't going to work, and you'll drop it. If you come as a, quote, true believer, certain that this is the right path for you, that meditation is the answer, the chances are you will soon become disappointed too. As soon as you find that you are the same person you always were, and that this work requires effort and consistency, and not just the romantic belief in the value of meditation or relaxation, you may find yourself with considerably less enthusiasm than before. In the stress reduction clinic, we find that those people who come with a skeptical but open attitude do the best. Their attitude is, I don't know whether this will work or not. I have my doubts, but I'm going to give it my best shot and see what happens. So the attitude that we bring to the practice of mindfulness will, to a large extent, determine its long-term value to us. This is why consciously cultivating certain attitudes can be very helpful in getting the most out of the process of meditation. Your intentions set the stage for what is possible. 7 attitudinal factors constitute the major pillars of mindfulness practice as we teach it in MBSR. They are non-judging, patience, a beginner's mind, trust, non-striving, acceptance, and letting go. These attitudes are to be cultivated consciously when you practice. They are not independent of each other. Each one relies on and influences the degree to which you are able to cultivate the others. Working on any one will rapidly lead you to the others, since together they constitute the foundation upon which you will be able to build a strong meditation practice of your own. We are introducing them before you encounter the techniques themselves, so that you can become familiar with these attitudes from the very beginning. It is amazing to me that we can be simultaneously completely preoccupied with the appearance of our own body and at the same time completely out of touch with it as well. Much of our preoccupation with how we look comes from a deep-seated insecurity about our bodies. Many of us grew up feeling awkward and unattractive and disliking our body for one reason or another. Usually it was because there was a particular ideal look that someone else had and we didn't. Sooner or later, people get over such preoccupations, but the root insecurity can remain about one's body. Many adults feel deep down that their body is either too fat or too short or too tall or too old or too, quote, ugly, as if there were some perfect way that it should be. Any deep feelings of this kind that you might have about your body can't change until the way you actually experience your body changes. When we put energy into actually experiencing our body, and we refuse to get caught up in the overlay of judgmental thinking about it, our whole view of it and of ourselves can change dramatically. To begin with, what it does is remarkable. It can walk and talk and sit up and reach for things. It can judge distance and digest food and know things through touch. Usually we take these abilities completely for granted and don't appreciate what our bodies can actually do until we are injured or sick. Then we realize how nice it was when we could do the things we can't do anymore. So before we convince ourselves that our bodies are too this or too that, shouldn't we get more in touch with how wonderful it is to have a body in the first place, no matter what it feels like or looks like? The way to do this is to tune into your body and be mindful of it without judging it. You have already begun this process by becoming mindful of your breathing in the sitting meditation. One very powerful technique we use to reestablish contact with the body is known as the body scan. Because of the thorough and minute focus on the body in the body scan, it is an effective technique for developing both concentration and flexibility of attention simultaneously. It involves lying on your back and moving your mind through the different regions of your body. We start with the toes of the left foot and slowly move up the foot and leg, feeling the sensations as we go and directing the breath into and out from the different regions. From the pelvis, we go to the toes of the right foot and move up the right leg back to the pelvis. From there, we move up through the torso, through the lower back and the abdomen, the upper back and the chest, and the shoulders. Then we go to the fingers of both hands and move up simultaneously in both arms, returning to the shoulders. Then we move through the neck and throat, and finally, all the regions of the face, and the back of the head and the top of the head. We wind up breathing through an imaginary hole in the very top of the head, as if we were a whale with a blowhole. We let our breathing move through the entire body from one end to the other, as if it were flowing in through the top of the head and out through the bottoms of the feet, and then in through the bottoms of the feet and out through the top of the head. By the time we have completed the body scan, it can feel as if the entire body has dropped away or has become transparent, as if its substance were in some way erased. It can feel as if there's nothing but breath flowing freely across all the boundaries of the body. Dr. Roger Walsh, professor of psychiatry and behavioral sciences at the University of California Irvine School of Medicine and a student of the interface between Eastern and Western psychologies, points out that meditation is what is called a consciousness discipline. Dr. Walsh emphasizes that the consciousness disciplines are based on a profoundly different paradigm from that of mainstream Western psychology. From the perspective of the consciousness disciplines, our ordinary state of waking consciousness is seen as severely suboptimal. Rather than contradicting the Western paradigm, it is really an extension of it beyond Western psychology's dominant concern with pathology and with therapies aimed at restoring people to normal functioning in the usual waking state of consciousness. At the heart of this perspective lies the conviction that it is essential for a person to engage in a personal, intensive, and systematic training of the mind through the discipline of meditation practice to free him or herself from the incessant distortions characteristic of our everyday emotional and thought processes, distortions that, as we have seen, can continually undermine the experience of our intrinsic wholeness. When we neglect the perspective of wholeness and interconnectedness, we only see one side of being alive. This view inflates the sense of my life, my problems, my loss, my pain as what is supremely important, and prevents us from seeing another, very real dimension of our own being that is not so separate or so unique. Seeing beneath the surface of things, behind appearances, or we might say, with eyes of wholeness, means recognizing that nothing occurs in isolation, that problems need to be seen within the context of whole systems. Seeing in this way, we can perceive the intrinsic web of interconnectedness underlying our experience and merge with it. Seeing in this way is itself healing. It helps us to acknowledge the ways in which we are extraordinary and miraculous, without losing sight of the ways in which we are simultaneously nothing special, just part of a larger whole unfolding, waves on the sea, rising up and falling back in brief moments we call lifespans. Food can also be used to cope with stress and emotional discomfort in a similar way. Using food for comfort can be a powerful addiction. People are also accustomed to using drugs to regulate their level of psychological well-being. Tranquilizers, for instance, are the most widely prescribed medication in the United States. They are most often prescribed for women. The message is, if you are feeling some discomfort or having trouble sleeping or are anxious or yelling at the kids all the time or overreacting to little things at home or at work, take one of these to take the edge off things, to be your old self, to get things under control. This attitude toward the validity of using drugs as the first line of defense to regulate anxiety reactions and symptoms of stress is very prevalent in medicine. There's nothing wrong with drugs per se. In fact, as we all know, medications play an extremely important role in medicine. But this attitude toward drugs pervades the entire society, not just medicine. Patients often come to the doctor with the expectation that they will be given something to help them. If they don't leave with a prescription, they might feel the doctor's not really trying to help. Given the prevalence of this attitude toward drugs, it is little wonder that there is an epidemic of illegal drug use in our country. Many of the ways people use chemicals, legal and illegal, for attaining a sense of control, peace of mind, relaxation, and good feelings inside themselves are, in essence, examples of maladaptive coping attempts. They're particularly unhealthy when they become habitual. The fact is that they ultimately add to the stress and pressure on us. Reliance on chemicals easily leads to distortions in perceptions, clouding our ability to see clearly, and undermining our motivation to find healthier ways to live. In these ways, they prevent us from growing and healing. These substances we seek out to relieve stress are also stressors on the body in their own right. Caffeine has been implicated in dysregulation of blood pressure and heart rate. Nicotine and the other chemicals in smoke, in heart disease, cancer, and lung disease, alcohol in liver, heart, and brain disease, and cocaine in cardiac arrhythmias and sudden cardiac death. All are psychologically addicting. Nicotine, alcohol, and cocaine are physiologically addicting as well. Of all the things we do on a regular basis, sleeping is one of the most extraordinary and least appreciated. Imagine, once a day on the average, we lie down on a comfortable surface and leave our bodies for hours at a time. It is sacred time, too. We are very attached to sleeping, and we almost never consider giving up some sleep on purpose to accomplish personal goals. How many times have you heard people say, "I need my 8 hours or I'll be a basket case"? And if you suggest to people that they might get up an hour earlier or even 15 minutes earlier to make time to do other things that they value but have no time for, you will find lots of resistance. People feel threatened when you tamper with their sleep time. Yet ironically, one of the most common and earliest symptoms of stress is trouble with sleep. If you're having a lot of trouble sleeping, your body may be trying to tell you something about the way you're conducting your life. As with all other mind-body symptoms, this message is worth listening to. Usually, it is just a signal that you're going through a stressful time in your life, and you can expect that if and when it is resolved, your sleeping pattern will improve by itself. Sometimes people get caught up in thinking that they need more sleep than they really do. Our need for sleep changes as we grow and is known to diminish as we get older. Some people can function well on 4 hours of sleep per night, but they may feel that they should be able to sleep longer. We recommend that when you can't sleep, you get out of bed and do something else for a while, something you like to do or that you might feel good about getting done. I like to assume that if I can't sleep, it may be because I don't need to be sleeping just then, even if I really want to be. When I have trouble sleeping, the second thing I do is meditate. The first is to toss and turn and feel upset until I realize what I'm doing. Then I get out of bed, wrap myself up in a warm blanket, sit on my cushion, and just watch my mind. This gives me a chance to look carefully at what is so pressing and agitating that it is keeping me from peaceful sleep. Sometimes meditating for a half hour or so will calm the mind to the point where you can go back to sleep. Other times it may lead you to do something else, such as work on a favorite project, make lists, read a good book, listen to music, or just accept the fact that you are upset, angry, fearful, whatever it may be, and be mindful of that. The middle of the night is also a good time to do yoga if you happen to be up. To handle sleeplessness in this way requires that you recognize and accept that you are already awake. Catastrophizing about how bad your day is going to be because you'll be so exhausted if you don't get back to sleep doesn't help. And forcing sleep doesn't help. So why not let the future take care of itself, especially since the fact is that right now you are already awake? Why not be fully awake? 1. Non-judging. Mindfulness is cultivated by assuming the stance of an impartial witness to your own experience. To do this requires that you become aware of the constant stream of judging and reacting to inner and outer experiences that we are all normally caught up in, and learn to step back from it. When we begin practicing paying attention to the activity of our own mind, it is common to discover and to be surprised by the fact that we are constantly generating judgments about our experience. Almost everything we see is labeled and categorized by the mind. We react to everything we experience in terms of what we think its value is to us. Some things, people, and events are judged as good because they make us feel good for some reason. Others are equally quickly condemned as bad because they make us feel bad. The rest is categorized as neutral because we don't think it has much relevance one way or the other. This habit of categorizing and judging our experience locks us into mechanical reactions that we are not even aware of and that often have no objective basis at all. These judgments tend to dominate our minds, making it difficult for us to ever find any peace within ourselves. If we are to find a more effective way of handling the stress in our lives, the first thing we will need to do is to be aware of these automatic judgments so that we can see through our own prejudices and fears and liberate ourselves from their tyranny. When you find the mind judging, you don't have to stop it from doing that. All that is required is to be aware of it happening. No need to judge the judging and make matters even more complicated for yourself. As an example, let's say you're practicing watching your breathing. At a certain point, you may find your mind saying something like, "This is boring," or "This isn't working," or "I can't do this." These are judgments. When they come up in your mind, it's very important to recognize them as judgmental thinking and remind yourself that the practice involves suspending judgment and just watching whatever comes up, including your own judging thoughts, without pursuing them or acting on them in any way. Then proceed with watching your breathing. 2. Patience. Patience is a form of wisdom. It demonstrates that we understand and accept the fact that sometimes things must unfold in their own time. A child may try to help a butterfly to emerge by breaking open its chrysalis. Usually the butterfly doesn't benefit from this. Any adult knows the butterfly can only emerge in its own time, that the process cannot be hurried. In the same way, we cultivate patience toward our own minds and bodies when practicing mindfulness. We intentionally remind ourselves that there is no need to be impatient with ourselves because we find the mind judging all the time, or because we are tense or agitated or frightened, or because we've been practicing for some time and nothing positive seems to have happened. We give ourselves room to have these experiences. Why? Because we are having them anyway. After all, each one is your life in that moment. When you practice being with yourself in this way, you are bound to find that your mind has a mind of its own. We have already seen that one of its favorite activities is to wander into the past and into the future and lose itself in thinking. Patience can be a particularly helpful quality to invoke when the mind is agitated. It can help us to accept this wandering tendency of the mind while reminding us that we don't have to get caught up in its travels. To be patient is simply to be completely open to each moment, accepting it in its fullness, knowing that things can only unfold in their own time. As we complete the body scan, we let ourselves dwell in silence and stillness, in an awareness that may have by this point gone beyond the body altogether. After a time, when we feel ready to, we refocus on our body, on a sense of the body as a whole. We feel it is solid again. We move our hands and feet intentionally. We might also massage the face and rock a little from side to side before opening our eyes and returning to the activities of the day. The idea in scanning your body is to actually feel each region you focus on and linger there with your mind right on it or in it. You breathe in to and out from each region a few times, and then let go of it in your mind's eye as your attention moves on to the next region. As you let go of the sensations you find in each region, and of any of the thoughts and inner images you may have found associated with it, the muscles in that region literally let go too, lengthening and releasing much of the tension they have accumulated. It helps if you can feel or imagine that the tension in your body and the feelings of fatigue associated with it are flowing out on each out-breath, and that on each in-breath you are breathing in energy, vitality, and relaxation. In the stress reduction clinic, we practice the body scan intensively for at least the first 4 weeks of the program. It is the first formal mindfulness practice that our patients engage in for a sustained period of time. Along with awareness of breathing, it provides the foundation for all the other meditation techniques that they will work with later, including the sitting meditation. It is in the body scan that our patients first learn to keep their attention focused over an extended period of time. It is the first technique they use to develop concentration, calmness, and mindfulness. For many people, it is the body scan that brings them to their first experience of well-being and timelessness in the meditation practice. It is an excellent place for anyone to begin formal mindfulness meditation practice. When you practice the body scan regularly for a while, you come to notice that your body isn't quite the same every time you do it. You become aware that your body is changing constantly, that even the sensations in, say, your toes may be different each time you practice. People sometimes have a hard time feeling their toes at first, or other parts of their body. Others, especially if they have a pain condition, may at first feel so overwhelmed by the pain that they have trouble concentrating on any other region of their body. Some people also find that they keep falling asleep. They have a hard time maintaining awareness as they get more relaxed. They just lose consciousness. These experiences, if they do happen, can all provide important messages to you about your own body. None of them is a serious obstacle if you are determined to work with them and go deeper in the practice. When we use the word healing to describe the experiences of people in the stress reduction clinic, what we mean above all is that they are undergoing a profound transformation of you. This transformation is brought about by the encounter with one's own wholeness, catalyzed by the meditation practice itself. We are constantly astonished at the ways in which our patients come to adapt the practice in their own lives and the effects that the practice comes to have on them. Most people come to the clinic because they want to learn to relax, but they often leave transformed beyond anything they had hoped to accomplish in the first place. For example, Hector was a wrestler from Puerto Rico who came with frequent angry outbursts and chest pain, and left having found control over both and having discovered a deep strain of gentleness he never knew he had. Healing, as we are using the word here, does not mean curing, although the two words are often used interchangeably. As we shall soon see, there are few, if any, outright cures for chronic diseases or for stress-related disorders. While it may not be possible for us to cure ourselves or to find someone who can, it is possible for us to heal ourselves. Healing implies the possibility for us to relate differently to illness, disability, even death, as we learn to see with eyes of wholeness. At the same time, we want to remain open to the possibility that the course of an illness might be positively influenced by a total state of mind-body integration. There is mounting evidence that this might be possible. A whole new field has emerged in the past few decades, known as psychoneuroimmunology, or PNI. Simply put, studies in this new field are showing that our body's many exquisite cellular and molecular defense mechanisms against infection and disease, known collectively as the immune system, do not operate in a vacuum to keep us healthy. As the term psychoneuroimmunology implies, the immune system is now known to be regulated in part at least by the nervous system, which integrates all the organ systems of the body so that we can function harmoniously as a unified organism. And of course, the nervous system makes the life of the mind possible. So there appear to be important interconnections, as yet only poorly understood, between the brain and the immune system. This means that science now has at least a plausible working model to explain how our thoughts and emotions and life experiences might, under some circumstances, influence our susceptibility or resistance to disease. Many experiments have now been conducted which suggest that experiences of uncontrollable stress in animals produce deficits in immune function and decrease natural resistance to cancers and tumor growth. Studies with people are also showing intriguing connections between stress, feelings of helplessness, immune system deficits, and diseases such as cancer. Ultimately, a major question for future research is the extent to which the mind might influence the healing of specific diseases, not simply indirectly by changing lifestyle, important as such changes are, but also by directly influencing the functioning of the immune system. Psychoneuroimmunology receives widespread coverage in the popular press. Having heard about the various experimental results of research studies, many people with cancer or AIDS now want to learn to meditate to control their stress, with the expectation that by doing so, they will be able to stimulate their immune system to combat their disease more effectively. But while it is entirely possible that practicing meditation and specific visualizations might significantly influence immune function, as we have noted, that conjecture is far from proven at this time. A person can live for many years cycling through episodes of stress and stress reactivity, followed by maladaptive attempts to keep body and mind under control, followed by more stress, followed by more maladaptive coping. If you are in this situation, the people closest to you are probably trying to get you to see it and to admit it and seek professional help. But it is very easy to discount what other people are telling you and even to deny what your own body or mind is trying to tell you when your habits have become a way of life. Sooner or later, the accumulated effects of stress reactivity, compounded by inadequate ways of dealing with it, lead to breakdown in one form or another. What gives out first will depend to a large extent on your genes, on your environment, and on the particulars of your maladaptive lifestyle. The weakest link is what goes first. If you have a strong family history of heart disease, you might have a heart attack, especially if other factors that increase the risk of heart disease, such as smoking, a high-fat diet, high blood pressure, and cynical and hostile behavior toward others are prominent features of your life. Whatever the actual form of the breakdown, if it does not result in death, then it is just one more major stressor that you now have to face and work with on top of all the others you already had in your life. There is another stress reaction pathway that becomes important when a person is faced with unavoidable stress sustained over long periods of time. Examples might be caring for an elderly parent who is ill or who has Alzheimer's disease, or caring for a disabled child. Here, all the stressors of daily living are compounded by a whole other set of potentially overwhelming stressors associated with the long-term demands of the situation. If adequate short- and long-term strategies for adapting to the situation are not developed, the pressures of daily living can mount to the point where the person is constantly in a state of hyperarousal, reacting repeatedly to even insignificant stressors with tension, irritability, and anger. However, continued arousal with little ultimate control over the fundamental stressor can reach the point where feelings of helplessness and hopelessness begin to dominate. Rather than hyperarousal, chronic depression can set in, leading to a different spectrum of hormonal and immune system changes that over time can also undermine health and lead to breakdown. Other people can be a big source of stress in our lives. We all have times when we feel that others are controlling our lives, making demands on our time, are being unusually difficult or hostile, don't do what we expect them to, or don't care about us and our feelings. We can probably all think of particular people who cause us stress, people we prefer to avoid if we can, but often can't because we live with them or work with them or have obligations that have to be met. In fact, many of the people who cause us the most stress may be people we love very deeply. We all know that love relationships can occasion deep emotional pain as well as joy and pleasure. Our relationships with other people provide us with unending opportunities for practicing mindfulness and thereby reducing what you might call people stress. Our stress cannot be said to be solely due to external stressors because psychological stress arises from the interaction between us and the world. So in the case of people who quote-unquote cause us stress, we need to take responsibility for our part in those relationships, for our own perceptions, thoughts, feelings, and behavior. Just as in any other unpleasant or threatening situation, we can react unconsciously with some version of the fight or flight reaction when we are having a problem with another person, and this usually makes matters worse in the long run. The word communication suggests a flow of energy through a common bond. As with communion, it implies a union, a joining or sharing. So to communicate is to unite, to have a meeting or union of minds. This does not necessarily mean agreement. It does mean seeing the situation as a whole and understanding the other person's view as well as one's own. When we are totally absorbed in our own feelings and our own view and agenda, it is virtually impossible to have a genuine communication. The patience, wisdom, and firmness that can come out of a moment of mindfulness in the heat of a stressful interpersonal situation yield fruit almost immediately because the other person usually senses that you cannot be intimidated or overwhelmed. He or she will feel your calmness and self-confidence and will in all likelihood be drawn toward it because it embodies inner peace. When you are willing to be secure enough in yourself to listen to what other people want and how they see things without constantly reacting, objecting, arguing, fighting, resisting, making yourself right and them wrong, they will feel heard, welcomed, accepted. This feels good to anybody. They will then be much more likely to hear what you have to say as well. Maybe not right away, but as soon as the emotions recede a little, there will be more of a chance for communication and for an actual communion of sorts, a meeting of minds, and an acknowledging and coming to terms with differences. In this way, your mindfulness practice can have a healing effect on your relationships. 3, Beginner's Mind. The richness of present moment experience is the richness of life itself. Too often we let our thinking and our beliefs about what we know prevent us from seeing things as they really are. We tend to take the ordinary for granted and fail to grasp the extraordinariness of the ordinary. To see the richness of the present moment, we need to cultivate what has been called beginner's mind, a mind that is willing to see everything as if for the first time. An open beginner's mind allows us to be receptive to new possibilities and prevents us from getting stuck in the rut of our own expertise, which often thinks it knows more than it does. As an experiment, you might try to cultivate your own beginner's mind in your daily life. The next time you see somebody who is familiar to you, ask yourself if you are seeing this person with fresh eyes, as he or she really is, or if you are only seeing the reflection of your own thoughts about this person. Try it with your children, your spouse, your friends and co-workers, with your dog or cat if you have one. Try it with problems when they arise. 4. Trust. Developing a basic trust in yourself and your feelings is an integral part of meditation training. It is far better to trust in your intuition and your own authority, even if you make some mistakes along the way, than always to look outside yourself for guidance. This attitude of trusting yourself and your own basic wisdom and goodness is very important in all aspects of the meditation practice. It will be particularly useful in the yoga. When practicing yoga, you will have to honor your own feelings when your body tells you to stop or to back off in a particular stretch. If you don't listen, you might wind up injuring yourself. Some people who get involved in meditation get so caught up in the reputation and authority of their teachers that they don't honor their own feelings and intuition. They believe that their teacher must be a much wiser and more advanced person, so they think they should imitate him or do what he says without question and venerate him or her as a model of perfect wisdom. This attitude is completely contrary to the spirit of meditation, which emphasizes being your own person and understanding what it means to be yourself. It is impossible to become like somebody else. Your only hope is to become more fully yourself. That is the reason for practicing meditation in the first place. Teachers and books and CDs can only be guides, signposts. In practicing mindfulness, you are practicing taking responsibility for being yourself and learning to listen to and trust your own being. The more you cultivate this trust in your own being, the easier you will find it will be to trust other people more and to see their basic goodness as well. In practicing the body scan, you tune into the various regions one by one and feel whatever sensations are apparent in each region. If, for instance, you tune into your toes and you don't feel anything, then not feeling anything is your experience of your toes at that particular time. That is neither bad nor good, it's simply your experience in that moment. So we note it and accept it and move on. It's not necessary to wiggle your toes to try to stir up sensations in that region, so that you can feel them, although that is okay too at the beginning. The body scan is especially powerful in cases where there is a particular region of your body that is problematic or painful. Take chronic low back pain as one example. Let's say that when you lie down on your back to do the body scan, you feel considerable pain in your lower back that is not relieved by minor shifts in your position. You start off with awareness of your breathing nevertheless, and then try to move your attention to the left foot, breathing in and out to the toes. But the pain in your back keeps drawing your attention to that region and prevents you from concentrating on the toes or on any other regions. You just keep coming back to your lower back and to the pain. One way to proceed when this happens is to keep bringing your attention back to your toes and redirecting the breath to that region each time the back captures your attention. You continue to move up systematically through your left leg, then your right leg, then the pelvis, all the while paying meticulous attention to the sensations in the various regions and to whatever thoughts and feelings you become aware of, regardless of their content. Of course, much of their content may concern your lower back and how it is feeling. As you then move through the pelvis and approach the problem region, you remain open and receptive, noting with precision the sensations you are experiencing as you move into this region, just as you did for all preceding regions. Now you breathe in to the back and out from the back, at the same time being aware of any thoughts and feelings as they occur. You dwell here breathing until, when you are ready, you let go of the lower back on purpose and move the focus of your attention to the upper back and the chest. In this way, you are practicing moving through the region of maximum intensity, experiencing it fully in its turn when you come to focus on it. You allow yourself to be open to all the sensations that may be there, in all their intensity, watching them, breathing with them, and then letting them go as you move on. From our point of view, an individual who comes to the stress reduction clinic with the strong expectation that his or her immune system can be strengthened by meditating might actually be creating impediments to his or her own healing. Too strong an investment in making your immune system respond the way you want it to might be more of a problem than a help, because the quality and the spirit of the meditation practice can easily be undermined by any goal orientation. If the essence of meditation is non-doing, then trying to work it around to getting what you want can distort and undermine those very qualities of letting go and acceptance that allow you to experience wholeness, in our view, the foundation for healing. This would be true even if it is ultimately shown that meditation can lead to positive changes in immune function that result in an increased ability of the body to heal disease processes. This is not to say that you cannot use meditation for specific ends. There are countless ways of incorporating specific visualizations and goals into meditation practice. In all the meditative traditions of the world, visualizations and imagery are used to invoke particular states of mind. There are meditations on love, God, loving kindness, peace, forgiveness, selflessness, impermanence, and suffering. There are meditations on energy, body states, particular emotions, compassion, generosity, wisdom, death, and of course, healing. Imagery and specific channeling of one's energy and attention are integral to these practices. However, it is important to emphasize that they are all practices engaged in with a systematic discipline and commitment, and always within the larger context of meditation as a way of being. When we take them up as isolated techniques that we invoke only when we feel bad or when we want something, we invariably ignore or discard this greater context. In fact, we may not even realize that it exists. In any event, the great wisdom and power inherent in the non-doing perspective can easily be lost or overlooked, and with it, the deeper power of the particular visualization. There is little wisdom in this approach, and potentially a great deal of frustration, disappointment, and wasted energy. In order to be effective for healing, we believe that the use of visualization and imagery needs to be embedded in a larger context, one that understands and honors non-doing and non-striving. Otherwise, visualization exercises can too easily degenerate from meditation into just wishful thinking, and the intrinsic healing power and wisdom of the simple mindfulness practice itself can remain untapped or be trivialized in the quest for something more elaborate and goal-oriented. Even in the simple case of lowering blood pressure, which meditation has been shown to do in numerous clinical studies, it's not wise to meditate primarily for that purpose. It tends to make the meditation mechanical and too success and failure-oriented. We believe that it is far more effective just to practice the meditation regularly and let your blood pressure take care of itself. From our experiences, we believe that symptom reduction and a transformation of perspective are more likely to occur if you actively cultivate non-doing in the meditation practice rather than preoccupy yourself with what your blood pressure, particular symptoms, or your immune system is doing. Breakdown in the stress reaction pathway does not have to be primarily physical. Too much stress and not enough effective coping can lead to a depletion of psychological resources to the point where you might experience what is sometimes called a nervous breakdown, a feeling of being completely unable to function in your ordinary life anymore. This condition may reach the point of requiring hospitalization and drug treatment. Nowadays, it's fashionable to use the word burnout to describe a similar state of near or total psychological exhaustion with an accompanying loss of drive and enthusiasm for the details of your life. What used to give you pleasure no longer does. As with the physical examples of breakdown, if psychological breakdown occurs, it becomes one more major stressor that the person now has to deal with one way or another. When you are caught up in this vicious cycle, it seems that it is just the way life is, that there is no other way. You might think to yourself that this is just a part of getting older, a normal decline in health, a normal loss of energy or enthusiasm, or feelings of control. But getting stuck in the stress reaction cycle is neither normal nor inevitable. The healthy alternative to being caught up in this self-destructive pattern is to stop reacting to stress and to start responding to it. This is the path of mindfulness in daily life. And so, we come back to the key importance of mindfulness. The very first and most important step in breaking free from a lifetime of stress reactivity is to be mindful of what is actually happening while it is happening. The stress response is the healthy alternative to the stress reaction. It represents collectively what we call adaptive or healthy coping strategies, as opposed to maladaptive attempts to cope with stress. By definition, stress reactions happen automatically and unconsciously. As soon as you bring awareness to what is going on in a stressful situation, you have already changed that situation dramatically, just by virtue of not being unconscious and on automatic pilot anymore. You are now fully present while the stressful event is unfolding. And since you are an integral part of the whole situation, by increasing your level of awareness, you are actually changing the entire situation even before you do anything. This inner change can be extremely important because it gives you a range of options for influencing what will happen next. Bringing awareness to such a moment only takes a split second, but it can make a critical difference in the outcome of a stressful encounter. If you manage to remain centered in that moment of stress, and recognize both the stressfulness of the situation and your impulses to react, as we have said, you have already introduced a new dimension into the situation. Because of this, you don't have to suppress all your thoughts and feelings associated with heightened arousal to prevent yourself from going out of control. You can actually allow yourself to feel threatened or fearful or angry or hurt, and to feel the tension in your body in these moments. Being conscious in the present, you can easily recognize these agitations for what they are, namely thoughts and feelings and sensations. This simple momentary shift from mindless reaction to mindful recognition can reduce the power of the stress reaction and its hold over you. In that moment, you now have a very real choice. You can still go the route of the stress reaction, but you no longer have to. You no longer have to react automatically in the same old way every time your buttons get pushed. You can respond instead out of your greater awareness of what is happening. One good way to increase mindfulness of communication is to actually keep a log of stressful communications for a whole week. This involves an awareness of the person with whom you're having the difficulty, how it came about, what you really wanted from the person or situation, what the other person wanted from you, an awareness of what was actually happening and what came out of it, as well as how you were feeling at the time it was happening. Just keeping track of stressful communications and of your own thoughts, feelings, and behavior while they are happening provides major clues about how you might behave differently to achieve your ends more effectively. Some people come to realize that much of their stress comes from not knowing how to be assertive about their own priorities when interacting with others. They may not even know how to communicate what they are really feeling, or they feel that they don't have a right to feel what they are feeling, or they may feel afraid about expressing their feelings. Some feel absolutely incapable of ever saying no to other people, even though they know that to say yes means that their own resources will be taxed to the limit or beyond. They feel guilty doing something for themselves or having plans of their own. They are always ready to serve others at the expense of themselves, not because they've transcended their own physical and psychological needs and have become saints, but because they believe that that is what they, quote, should do to be a so-called good person. Sadly, this often means that they are always helping other people, but feel incapable of nourishing or helping themselves. That would be too selfish, too self-centered. Thus, they put other people's feelings first, but for the wrong reasons. Deep down, they may be running away from themselves by serving other people, or they may be doing it to gain approval from others, or because they were taught and now think that that is the way to be a good person. This behavior can create enormous stress, because you are not replenishing your own inner resources, nor are you aware of your own attachments to the role you have adopted. You can exhaust yourself running around doing good and helping others, and in the end be so depleted that you are incapable of doing any good at all, and unable to help even yourself. It's not the doing things for others that is the source of the stress here. It is the lack of peace and harmony in your own mind as you engage in all the doing. If you decide that you have to say no more often and define certain limits in your relationships so that you might bring your life into balance, you will discover that there are a lot of ways you might do it. Here is where authentic assertiveness training can be very useful. What assertiveness training amounts to is mindfulness of feelings, speech, and actions. The first lesson in assertiveness is that your feelings are simply your feelings. They are neither good nor bad. Good and bad are just judgments that you or others impose on your feelings. To act assertively really requires a non-judging awareness of your feelings as they are. 5. Non-striving. Almost everything we do for a purpose, to get something or somewhere. But in meditation, this attitude can be a real obstacle. That's because meditation is different from all other human activities. Although it takes a lot of work and energy of a certain kind, ultimately, meditation is a non-doing. It has no goal other than for you to be yourself. The irony is that you already are. This sounds paradoxical and a little crazy, yet this paradox and craziness may be pointing you toward a new way of seeing yourself, one in which you are trying less and being more. This comes from intentionally cultivating the attitude of non-striving. For example, if you sit down to meditate and you think, I'm going to get relaxed or get enlightened or control my pain or become a better person, then you have introduced an idea into your mind of where you should be, and along with it comes the notion that you are not okay right now. If I were only more calm or more intelligent or a harder worker or more this or more that, if only my heart were healthier or my knee were better, then I would be okay, but right now, I'm not okay. This attitude undermines the cultivation of mindfulness, which involves simply paying attention to whatever is happening. If you are tense, then just pay attention to the tension. If you are in pain, then be with the pain as best you can. If you are criticizing yourself, then observe the activity of the judging mind. Just watch. Remember, we're simply allowing anything and everything that we experience from moment to moment to be here because it already is. As you will see shortly, in the meditative domain, the best way to achieve your own goals is to back off from striving for results and instead to start focusing carefully on seeing and accepting things as they are, moment by moment. With patience and regular practice, movement toward your goals will take place by itself. 6. Acceptance. Acceptance means seeing things as they actually are in the present. If you have a headache, accept that you have a headache. If you are overweight, why not accept it as a description of your body at this time? Sooner or later, we have to come to terms with things as they are and accept them, whether it's a diagnosis of cancer or learning of someone's death. However, putting aside for a moment the major calamities that usually take a great deal of time to heal from, in the course of our daily lives, we often waste a lot of energy denying and resisting what is already fact. If you are overweight and feel bad about your body, it's no good to wait until you're the weight you think you should be before you start liking your body and yourself. At a certain point, if you don't want to remain stuck in a frustrating, vicious cycle, you might realize that it is all right to love yourself at the weight that you are now, because this is the only time that you can love yourself. Remember, now is the only time you have for anything. You have to accept yourself as you are before you can really change. When you start thinking this way, losing weight becomes less important. It also becomes a lot easier. By intentionally cultivating acceptance, you are creating the preconditions for healing. Acceptance does not mean that you have to like everything or that you have to take a passive attitude toward everything and abandon your principles and values. It does not mean that you're satisfied with things as they are or that you're resigned to tolerating things as they, quote, have to be. It does not mean that you should stop trying to break free of your own self-destructive habits or to give up on your desire to change and grow, or that you should tolerate injustice, for instance, or avoid getting involved in changing the world around you because it's the way it is and therefore hopeless. Acceptance, as we are speaking of it, simply means that you have to come around to a willingness to see things as they are. In the meditation practice, we cultivate acceptance by taking each moment as it comes and being with it fully as it is. The body scan can be thought of as an act of purification of the body. The moving zone of your attention harvests tension and pain as it passes through various regions and carries them to the top of your head, where, with the aid of your breathing, you allow them to discharge out of your body, leaving it purified. Each time you scan your body in this way, you can think of it or visualize it as a purification or detoxification process, a process that is promoting healing by restoring a feeling of wholeness and integrity to your body. Although it sounds as if the body scan is being used to achieve a specific end, namely, to purify your body, the spirit in which we practice it is still one of non-striving. Through repeated practice of the body scan over time, we come to grasp the reality of our body as whole in the present moment. This feeling of wholeness can be experienced no matter what is wrong with your body. One part of your body, or many parts of your body, may be diseased or in pain or even missing, yet you can still cradle them in this experience of wholeness. Each time you scan your body, you are letting what will flow out, flow out. You are not trying to force either letting go or purification to happen, which, of course, is impossible anyway. Letting go is really an act of acceptance of your situation. It is not a surrender to your fears about it. It is a seeing of yourself as larger than your problems and your pain, larger than your cancer, larger than your heart disease, larger than your body, and identifying with the totality of your being rather than with your body or your heart or your back or your fears. The experience of wholeness transcending your problems comes naturally out of regular practice of the body scan. It is nurtured every time you breathe out from a particular region and let it go. Another way of dealing with pain when it comes up during the body scan is to let your attention go to the region of greatest intensity. This strategy is best when you find it difficult to concentrate on different parts of your body because the pain in one region is just so great. Instead of scanning, you just breathe into and out from the pain itself. Try to imagine or feel the in-breath penetrating into the tissue until it is completely absorbed, and imagine the out-breath as a channel, allowing the region to discharge to the outside, whatever.